You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a wonderful December day. You notice I didn't say bright and sunny because I haven't seen the sun for weeks.
We actually briefly, today's date is December 17th, 2025 for a show to broadcast December 18th, 2025. December 16th, the sun briefly came out.
In west, Don's area.
Well, no, west of Davis, because yep. We ran out of the nursery. We went out and we took pictures of it to prove this event. And the temperature for the first time in 3 weeks went above 45 degrees. It went up to 49 degrees yesterday, Tuesday. And that's been the pattern. I had to go back, finally, having conversations with other old timers here about, boy, I remember this kind of thing from the 1980s. And we did. We remembered a distinct period of extremely cold, foggy weather that occurred where there was something like 15 days straight that we did not see the sun. I actually found the dates. That was 1985. Now, remember, wow, we didn't have internet or things like that in 1985. So how did I find this? I was looking at chilling hours for fruit trees, and they've been recording chilling hours at the UC Davis campus at one weather station since 1982. On a day that we don't get above 45 degrees and we don't get below freezing, we have 24 hours of chilling hours in a 24-hour period.
We have so many chilling hours this year. We could grow anything.
We had 10 days straight now, at least, when we've had 24 chilling hours in 24 hours. And before that, we had several likewise. Well, the last time that happened was the last 2 weeks of December 1985, when we had 2+ weeks straight without any sunshine or rain or wind or anything, just literally fog. If you want a really, really good overview of what's been happening in California and the entire West, I refer you over to our favorite weather blog, weatherwest.com, where Daniel Swain updates you on weather and climate. And he gives a full overview of what's happening here. We have very, very strong temperature inversion, a high pressure, I'll call it a cap, trapping fog in the Central Valley. You can see all kinds of great satellite imagery of the giant bathtub that is the California Central Valley, completely filled with fog all the way for the last 2 to 3 weeks. And the sun literally has not come out that entire time. We've had a couple weeks now where the valley has been extremely cold. I mean, 41 to 45 degrees has literally been our temperature range for more than 2 weeks. We got down to 39 a couple of times. We did not get above 45 for 3 weeks straight. Yesterday, we went up to 49 degrees.
So a break in the weather, Don?
We do have a break in the weather because we are actually we're getting a storm coming in today as we're preparing this show for broadcast. That's already happening. We're getting some air movement, some mixing, which really had not happened. Now we do have a storm coming in. As I look to the southwest, I actually see gaps in clouds, not significant gaps, but gaps in clouds, which is great. There's a bit of a change coming in. And once this clears through our area, we might actually get some sun. Today, Wednesday, day of the broadcast, mostly cloudy, but 57 degrees, which would be a big difference. Thursday night, 50 degrees, chance of showers. Now we're going into a different pattern for basically the rest of December. Friday will be 56, showers likely. Friday night, 53, showers. Saturday, 56, showers likely. Saturday night, 53, showers. Sunday, 58, showers. Monday, Showers likely, 56. Monday night, 50. Showers likely. Tuesday, showers likely. So what we've been through, as Daniel Swain puts it at Weather West, denizens of places like Sacramento, Stockton, Fresno, other valley population centers have been shivering through a period featuring one of the chilliest daytime high temperatures in recent memory, decades in some spots. Other locations just a mile or two away have been literally having record warm temperatures. Indeed, so far this December, it has often been warmer, even at night, at locations a mile up in the Sierra than it has been in Sacramento. A truly bizarre statistic made possible by this incredibly strong and persistent temperature inversion and high pressure aloft. Meanwhile, in Southern California, it has felt like July and December with many days in a row of mostly sunny and dry conditions, with afternoon high temperatures in SoCal ranging from the 70s to 80s and even a few 90 degree temperatures in the hottest spots. Warm atmospheric rivers are making southward progress. Rain will be coming into our area. It will end the persistent Northern California fog and, of course, bring additional flood risk up to the Pacific Northwest. A nearly continuous stream of generally quite warm atmospheric rivers, including some of what he calls the mango slash pineapple express variety, with some level of moisture connection to the deep subtropical Pacific, will affect some portion of the Pacific coast of North America. This will affect the Pacific Northwest once again overnight into Monday, bringing renewed flooding and landslide risk, and they will be spreading further south. And this is what we'll be on the edge of in the Sacramento area. The ridge will slowly begin to budge, shifting eastward at a painstakingly slow yet perceptible pace. Extremely warm, in some cases record warm air mass, will persist over the interior west and even over portions of California. And the Pacific jet stream will slowly sag over Oregon, allowing the atmospheric river parade to aim somewhat farther southward. So Oregon should get plenty wet. The north coast of California could even see some relatively gentle rainfall by Monday, Tuesday. By later in the week, this will continue to incrementally allow the Pacific storm track to inch southward. You get the pattern here. Eventually, allowing a moist plume associated with warm atmospheric river corridor to make it as far south as the Interstate 80 corridor by midweek.
No, it's going to be right. Yeah. I'm 2 miles south of the freeway. It's not going to hit me.
And they always use I-80 as a demarcation because that is often the pattern the storms take. He says this will be a fairly gradual process. This is not the kind of pattern that will generate dramatically stormy weather in California. Widespread light to moderate warm rains will develop increasingly far south over Northern California. Keep in mind, there is no snowpack right now. So near record or record low snowpack in the Sierra Nevada may persist for at least another 7 to 10 days. Head over to weatherwest.com, read his whole explanation. We're finally getting out of the dreary fog and into rain. 60 yep. miles east or west, or a few hundred miles north or south, would get out of the fog pretty quickly. The layer was about 1,500 feet. But it's going away. That's the good news. The other good news is we've gained a lot of chilling hours. So we went from, over the last 6 years, comparing year to year, we went from last place to second place in terms of chilling hours accumulated. We're well over 400 chilling hours, 450 chilling hours now, and it isn't even the end of December. So fruit trees should be fine in the valley. What I'm curious about is the fruit trees above 1,500 feet, because folks in those areas have not been getting the same kind of chilling hours we have been getting. So it should be,
because it's been warmer up there.
That's correct. It's been warmer pretty much everywhere in the state of California. The effect that this is having, interestingly, we haven't had an actual killing frost, certainly not in town. We had like a brief 35 degrees, and I took a picture of some sparkling ice crystals about 3 weeks ago, and that was it. So the things like impatiens, begonias, that we would normally just would be black and ugly by now, they're still out there. They're still trying to bloom, but we're below 45 degrees day after day after day. Those are all subtropical plants, and they did not evolve with those kind of temperatures. You don't necessarily have to get to freezing to get injury. The cold is affecting them. My impatiens, which I'm leaving out there just to see what they do. Older leaves are yellowing. One branch of one plant died, looks like rot. They're still blooming. They're not dead because they haven't gotten to freezing, but they're different metabolic pathways within the plant are leading to leaf yellowing and decline. And probably those plants will just look worse and worse until we actually do get to a killing type frost, if we ever do this year. So you're seeing some impacts on plants that you wouldn't normally see. But part of that is because first part of November was very warm. They went into this weather thinking it, here it is, it's summer, we're still going to grow and bloom. And then we abruptly got cold and they're basically shutting down. They don't go dormant. They just sort of slowly shut down and gradually die of rot more commonly than anything else. KDRT is community radio. That's public radio. We rely on contributions from folks like you to keep this station running and bring you Davis Garden Show and all the other great programming here at KDRT. And if you are one of those people who likes to give money at the end of the year,
it's the end of the year, John.
Go to kdrt.org and click on the support button, and there we are. We'd love to be added to your list of end of the year giving sites. I want to mention that there's a new book published, and this is a good one. This is important for those of you maybe looking for a Christmas gift or something. Don't know if you'd get it in time, but certainly could order it. UCANR has updated and has a new edition of The Home Orchard, offering advice on growing tree fruit and nuts. The Home Orchard, Growing Your Own Deciduous Fruit and Nut Trees, second edition. Let's see, when was this last published? It's been a while. So they've 2007. So this is updated. This vital reference for backyard tree fruit growers has been significantly expanded beyond the common crops. Peaches, apples, now includes figs, persimmons, almonds, walnuts, pecans, chestnuts, filberts, and pistachios, says Paul Vossen, the Emeritus UC Cooperative Extension Farm Advisor and co-author. It includes integrated pest management guidance for each crop, 240-page resource, significantly expanded content, modern rootstock recommendations, water-efficient irrigation system design, and much, much more. So you can find out about this by going to one of our favorite sites, ucanr.edu. I found the link for this on their food blog. Okay, that's reasonable. But if you go to ucanr.edu, you can just type new home orchard book and it'll get you there. The Home Orchard updated, a great resource. The original one was fantastic. And this looks like it's going to be even better.
So we have a bunch of questions. Let's start with this one. Caitlin Walker writes to us, "Hi, Don and Lois. About 8 years ago, I started an asparagus bed in my backyard in Walnut Creek. It's growing pretty well and giving me plenty of asparagus. But last winter, for the first time, it started sprouting in December. Prior to that, it had never sprouted before March or so, which I think is more typical. This year, it's sprouting in December again. What's going on? And should I do anything about it? Just let the spears grow or harvest them in the middle of winter? Should I cut them off as soon as they break ground until a more appropriate season? If I start harvesting in December, when do I stop harvesting?"
Yeah.
Most things you read say 4 to 6 weeks, but they still don't really start producing very much until March. So a few more details in case they're pertinent. The bed is on the north side of an 8-foot fence, so it gets zero direct sunlight at this time of year. I also got quite a bad infestation of aphids on the asparagus this year in late summer and early fall. I've never noticed aphids on them before this year. Thanks for your help. I love your show. Caitlin.
So I planted asparagus on this property nearly 40 years ago in one area, and about a third of them still sprout every year. Asparagus can be a very long-lived plant.
Yep.
What I did that made that possible was I didn't really know this much about asparagus at the time, but I did know that the crowns need good drainage. So I dug a ditch and I took the soil from the ditch and I piled it up in a row and I planted essentially on top of that row. And then I piled several more inches of soil on top of them there. So for all these years, for all the flood years and drought years, excess water has always drained away from the crowns of the ones that are still sprouting four decades later.
Asparagus ridge.
Yes. And I had continued that all the way down to a point where it was essentially level soil, and those died out after several years. The ones at level soil, because of flood years that we do have here, just rotted out. But the ones up high drained out. I go out and I try to remember to, one, cut back all that excess foliage sometime midwinter just so I can see what's going on. And then I try to remember to walk by these plants every few days if I can as we get into January, February, because when they sprout has varied from late January to early March during that time period. Typically, it's sometime in February that I see the first of the shoots come up. And the thing about asparagus is from when you see it break ground, you know, a shoot pushing up, you better harvest that one within about 1 to 2 days because they stretch so fast and become so fibrous that they're not palatable if you let them go too big. So my pattern has always been whenever they show up, I start harvesting and I harvest until the shoots that are coming up are thinner, which is, again, as they say correctly, about 4 to 6 weeks typically. And then I let them grow out and grow fully out for the summer. They're a very pretty plant, very ferny looking, nice fall color, interestingly, something.
Good bead seeds. I mean, the seeds look like beads.
If you have them with seeds, you should remove those plants because they're female. The ones that don't have fruit, you should leave. This is advice I was given years ago, which I never adhere to, but it's advice that you're given. And the reason for that little bit of advice, slight digression, is that if you let those fruit reseed, it'll degrade the stand because you'll get seedlings coming up that aren't the variety that you planted. And that's all true. They'll still be edible. They'll still be okay. It's not like it's that big a deal. But they will tell you if you get those pretty orange berries on there that you should remove those plants because they're female. You can buy predominantly male cultivars. These are all things you can do if you choose to do so. But there are male and female plants. The fruit are kind of pretty. So I don't pull them out. I just take pictures of them in the fall when you get the fall color.
And if you have, you know, a row and they're all male except one, mm-hmm. we could take that one out, dig it up. And yes, you can transplant asparagus.
Oh, yeah.
Dig it up and go put it someplace where it's going to be a beautiful bush. Although, and don't worry about eating it.
I should mention that asparagus can reseed like crazy. So it can be, I won't say invasive, but it can certainly become a bit of a garden thug if you do allow those females to fruit. The digression here, they're probably coming up early because of the temperatures. I believe that you in Walnut Creek were not as foggy as us in the valley. So you've had unusually warm temperatures. That's my guess. I didn't check your weather data, but my guess is that East Bay was much less affected by this dreary weather than the rest of us. And I do know that the sprouting of asparagus is soil temperature related. So once they've gone into their dormancy and come out of it, which doesn't take much for them to do, they'll go ahead and sprout. The important thing if you're growing a long-term bed of asparagus is not to harvest so much that you're weakening the root system. So right. You harvest when they're big and vigorous and the new shoots keep coming out smaller. And at some point you think, okay, if they're the size of a pencil, they're getting down to the point where I'm stressing the plant. So I'll just let those grow out, rebuild the root system for next year. So I think what you're seeing is almost entirely weather related. That's always our go-to answer in horticulture anyway. But I think in this case, it's accurate. And the answer is harvest. Go ahead and harvest any that you see. And then as they start getting smaller, 4 to 6 weeks is about right. Go ahead and let it start growing up. The aphids do occur. I've had years where I get aphids on asparagus and they just kind of run their course. People should, if you're planting asparagus and you're serious about it, go to a nursery and actually buy some of the cultivars of asparagus that are out there. There's 3 or 4 of them. There's a purple one, by the way, that's really cool. My experience with that one is it only lasted 3 or 4 years and kind of died out, but it was sweet. It was unusually large spears. It was great. And it was purple in color. And there's a couple of well-known strains of asparagus, one that's grown from seed, some that are grown from division. If you're looking for asparagus, the time to find bare root asparagus, if nurseries are able to get them, January, they need good drainage. So in our area, that's just a matter of elevating them, you know, putting them in a raised bed or like I did on a furrow. They always tell you to have the crown several inches down. And the main reason for that is so you don't injure the crown as you're harvesting, because you do cut into the soil with your special asparagus knife. Great Christmas present, by the way. And the key is water draining away from the crown. They don't need special fertilizer. It's one of these funny ones where when we first opened, the standard advice was to turn in some well-rotted manure, which, you know, people don't have well-rotted manure. But in the past, the average farmstead, people would have a place with animals and they'd take that manure because they got to clean out the stalls every day and they'd pile it up in a place where it would rot. And so the well-rotted manure from your stables would go out for your asparagus beds. And I would see this in books as a recommendation for planting asparagus and think, how many people have well-rotted manure sitting around?
Well, it shows you how long asparagus has been grown.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, you can buy manure in bags, and it's a perfectly good way to fertilize asparagus. The key is the plants benefit from some gentle source of nitrogen at some point during the growing season. Manure is fine. Whatever else you prefer to use is also fine. And while I will say that asparagus as a plant is remarkably drought tolerant, asparagus for production should be watered like your vegetable garden. So the best place to put asparagus is in a bed that's on the edge of your vegetable garden, or especially on the back, so you can tie those beautiful ferny fronds up onto the fence and have a lovely fence covered with them all summer long. The fall color, as I mentioned, is great. So they take a lot of space. They'll sprawl all over the place unless you put them against a fence, and they don't sprawl into your tomatoes and your peppers if you do it that way. But keeping them watered like your regular vegetables will give better yield. If you stop watering, a lot of your other vegetables and herbs might die out, but I guarantee the asparagus will just go into an early dormancy. It'll be back with no problem.
All right. So we've talked about lots of different ways to support things like your tomato cages and trellises and espaliering against a fence and all that sort of stuff. Well, today, Gordon surprised me with a new one. I says, hello, I've been trying to get various climbing plants to root into moss poles.
Yep.
I have had some attached to walls, carpets, or even the floor, but no luck with moss poles. So I went and did a search to find out what the heck are moss pole.
Okay, we need to say, we're talking about sphagnum moss here, not like the moss that grows on your roof.
Right. This is that dry brown stuff.
Yeah. Okay, well, Gordon has been trying to get various climbing plants to root onto moss poles. I've had some attached to walls, carpets, even the floor.
So it's indoor plants.
But no luck with moss poles. Yeah, these are for indoor
plants. Indoor plants.
I've tied them to the poles with no luck. I'm thinking is because I can't keep them damp. Do you have any suggestions on how to keep them damp and receptive to aerial roots? Most of the ones I have are hollow tubes wrapped in some sort of fibrous material that seems almost hydrophobic. The fibrous material is sphagnum moss, and you can buy that typically loose in bags at garden centers. The key to making this successful is packing it in there. I mean, really, really, really firmly packing in so much that it's not loose and airy. You need enough that it will retain moisture. And then you've got to mist it all the time. Now, mostly this is used for aroids. Aroids are houseplants that are members of Araceae. Philodendrons, Pothos, Monstera are all aroids. And many of them are climbing vines that would, in nature, climb up a tree to the top of the rainforest canopy and then drop down aerial roots, which will then go into the cavity in a branch angle, which is full of leafy debris and dead animals. And that's where they gather their water and nutrients, or they'll go all the way down to the soil and root into the soil. The plant doesn't actually need them. So we get this question a lot when someone's buying a split leaf philodendron, Monstera, puts out those big white roots that just grow out into the air. It doesn't really need those. It's rooted into the pot that you bought it in, and that's where the root system is. Those are fine. If you want to make use of them, they can go on down into the soil if they grow long enough, or you can put them into something that has some moisture, such as a moss pole. You can buy them Amazon. We did a Google search, 15 sites on Amazon came up with moss poles. We've made them at our garden center because people do ask for these for this exact purpose Gordon's looking for. We pack the sphagnum in around a 1x1 stake that you also can buy at the hardware store, and then we hold it in place with something like chicken wire. Usually we use a finer mesh. We often use the same material that you would use to protect against gophers, that kind of pretty heavy gauge mesh. And you staple that on to the stake, and you pack in the sphagnum, and you pack it as tight as you possibly can. And I do recommend hydrating it before you do this, because it can be hydrophobic indeed. Sphagnum moss and peat moss can get hydrophobic and can be hard to rehydrate. Might as well hydrate it before, as you're putting this thing together, rather than trying to do it afterwards. And then you just take a little mister and you mist it all the time. And you can point those roots in there when they show up, and they'll go in there and they'll happily root inside that. But it's important to know the plant doesn't actually need that. It'll help stabilize it. It'll certainly gain some nutrients, but mostly moisture from rooting on into that sphagnum moss, but it is not essential. One of the more common uses I see for this is where people are taking ivy, some of the very fine leaf, tiny leaf ivies, or creeping fig, and they're growing it up onto something sort of like a topiary, or they just want it to cover a structure and it'll root into that. But then you do have to keep that moist, because that's not a plant that is living like a tropical rainforest aroid. These are plants where those roots are going to be rather important. And as you've noted, it dries out really fast. And so the more you can pack in there, the better in terms of retaining moisture.
So I'm reading carefully what Gordon sent, and he says, he's talking about his climbing plants. I have had some attached to walls, carpets, and even the floor.
Yeah.
So that makes me think that maybe they're more like the climbing plants that have suckers.
There are three basic kinds of vines. true vines. There are vines that hold on with tendrils. Grapes are a good example. They have a modified leaf that essentially reaches out, wraps around something, and then hardens into place. There are vines that simply scramble. Those are the ones that twine, like morning glory, just twines around whatever is there. Those are fascinating because if you put something for them to climb on a foot away, somehow magically, that vine realizes it's there, goes over there and starts twining up it. So it holds itself up simply by wrapping around things. And there are vines, and these are some of the worst in the business, that root onto what they're growing. Now, as a houseplant, not a big deal, but these are things like ivy, Boston ivy, and creeping fig. I don't even like to sell those. I don't stock them routinely in the case of the ivy or the creeping fig because they can do structural damage. They're actually rooting into what they're climbing on. So those concern me. The Boston ivy group, people back east know this one real well. We do have it out here. Virginia creeper, Boston ivy, silver vein creeper. These are parthenocissus. They're deciduous and they root onto but not into is the way it was explained to me once years ago. They're little sucker discs that attach to whatever they're climbing on, like the brick facade of the of Harvard. That's why they're called Ivy League schools, because there's Boston ivy all over the brick buildings. That's where the name comes from. They're not rooting in. If you do have to repaint or something, you pull them down, there's some stuff left behind, but a quick sandblast will take care of that. Whereas the ivy or the creeping fig is rooting in. It can get in around the window and do structural damage. So ivy and creeping fig are literally rooting into what they're growing on. That's what true vines do. We aren't usually growing a lot of true vines as houseplants, but the one that is the grape ivy, which is not a grape, nor is it an ivy. Classic example of a misleading common name. Cissus rhombifolia. If you grow it, you'll see the tendrils. It holds itself on with tendrils. So that's a true vine that you can train up onto things, although more commonly it's sold as a hanging basket plant to cascade downward. Those would root. I don't think that one roots in at all because it's holding itself on with tendrils. So you have plants that vary as to how they support themselves if they're vines. And the ones that are generally the focus of the moss poles are the aroids. Many years ago, I had a Monstera in a room that was climbing up a wall. It was not rooting onto the wall, fortunately, but one of these roots came out and made its way all the way down to my desk, which was up against that wall. So I took a pickle jar and I filled it with water and I let the root grow into the water. And then I started putting Schultz's liquid plant food, a few drops, into that water every so often. What happened was all the growth that came out past that point of where that root came down from, the leaf size doubled. So it was taking up the nutrients and making use of them up there as a new growth came out. So you can have fun with this. They will absorb nutrients. They will certainly absorb nitrogen, apparently based on my limited experiment there. And they can be used by the plant, but a lot of people don't like their appearance. So the flip side of this question is, do I have to leave those roots? Does it matter? No, you can break
them. You cut them off.
Cut them off. It does not hurt the plant. It does not absolutely need them. There's sort of like the plant's insurance when it's 80 to 100 feet up in the rainforest, wants to try and find another source of nutrients and water. It drops one of these roots down. Sometimes they go all the way down without ever encountering anything that they can take up water or nutrients because they are a protected root with that papery coating. Other times they go right into the trunk of a tree where there's a bunch of leaves that are rotting and they just happily flourish in there and they take up the nutrients and the moisture from there. So you're encouraging that, but it's not absolutely necessary. Great question. I get a lot of people who are houseplant enthusiasts looking for moss poles, and they've been a challenge to find from what I would call regular wholesale distributors. You can find them. Apparently Amazon has quite a number of sources on them. You can make your own. It's not that difficult to do. It's just a matter of finding the right kind of wire and the right kind of sphagnum moss. And so that's what you're looking for is sphagnum. It's spelled S-P-H-A-G-N-U-M. Sometimes people throw an extra H in there after the G, sphagnum moss. Hey.
So we have a couple more questions. Here's one. Chuck from Carmichael writes, "Hi Don and Lois, I have a question about one of my Japanese maples trees. I'm not sure of the exact name of the cultivar, but I bought it because the leaves were different than all my other Japanese maples. It has very thin, almost bamboo-like leaves.
Yeah, I like
Notice,
this one.
Notice, though, that some of the leaves are more common, wider, five-pointed leaves on some of the branches. These are not suckers generating below the graft, but Could there be rootstock coming through? Should I prune these out? I'm attaching pictures to help show what I'm talking about. I hope that helps. This tree is getting more sun than it used to, but it seems to be doing fine. I'm not sure if that would influence leaf size. I appreciate any advice, and I love your show.
This
Always
is
looking forward to listening and learning. Thank you.
what an interesting picture. This is a beautiful Japanese maple. I collect Japanese maples, and now I find I want this one, whatever it is. And yes, there's what appears to be a shoot on here with much larger leaves. And my immediate assumption would be that it probably would be coming from below the graft. So I would look very carefully to make sure, that you didn't misdiagnose that. Japanese maples are almost always grafted. Cultivars are. Seedlings are easy to grow. Lois can tell you all about it. Seedlings are very, very
Anybody want a
easy.
seedling?
Yeah, anybody need a seedling? Give us a call. The seedlings are easy, but they're variable. If you grow Acer palmatum from seed, you'll get mostly green, mostly large leaf, but occasional red. So those are just labeled atropurpureum. Believe it or not, that's how the red leaf Japanese maple that is not a cultivar is usually created. It's just red leafed seedlings. Some of the leaves will be edged with serration, others will not. Some of them will be smaller, some will be bigger, but you'll get that variability when you grow them from seed. So if you want a particular one, like the really red leaf one or the thread leaf ones or the ones that have particular fall color or unique growth habit, they don't root from cuttings at all. They just don't root. So they're almost always grafted. And they're grafted onto seedling Acer palmatum. They just plant seeds, which are easy. They take the scion of the one that they want and they graft it onto that, just as we do with fruit trees and whatnot. So if the rootstock does come up, it's going to be different and it's going to look like a basic green generic Japanese maple, which, by the way, is a great tree. I mean, you don't have to pay hundreds of dollars for a fancy leaf Japanese maple. If you just want a nice, lacy-ish looking tree for an understory tree, the seedlings are beautiful and they're somewhat variable.
Ask Lois, she's got
Ask anybody who has one. There's a one exception to what I said, and then I'll come back to your question. Bloodgood variety, which is a red leaf Japanese maple, it is the most common red leaf Japanese maple other than Atropurpureum. Bloodgood has got a wider leaf, a more consistent red color. Someone observed years and years ago in the nursery trade that seedlings from Bloodgood virtually came true. In other words, true enough, close enough that most of us wouldn't know that it wasn't a grafted scion, grafted clone. It was actually a seedling. Bloodgood seedlings look like the parent. So for a long time now, there have been seedling grown Bloodgood and grafted clones of Bloodgood, which are technically two different plants. But if you want to be like absolutely sure I'm getting the clone, look for the graft union because some red leaf Japanese maples sold as Bloodgood are actually seedlings. They will look in your garden, you and I would be fine with them. But a Japanese maple aficionado who's a little more perspicacious than I am would probably think, oh, this is fake. This is not real. Okay, so the purists don't like that. That particular one can be grown from seed. All the others are grafted. And so looking at your picture, if you hadn't given me the background, I would assume that this was rootstock coming up. The other.
I have a question here because I know in some trees, some bushes, plants, whatever, if you get something that's different than typical, sometimes one new branch will come out and will be typical. So it's like sort of a anti-sport.
Well, it is a sport. It's a reversion, I guess, if you will, but it's a sport, sure. And
Well, couldn't
that's
you just cut
possible.
out that part?
If you don't want it to take over, that's what you would do. If it's a root sucker, it's a pretty good chance it'll grow more vigorously than the top, it would take over. If it's a sport, which is what you're describing, a spontaneous local mutation, this happens on many types of plants. It's a lot of citrus, a lot of roses. It certainly could happen on Japanese maples. Anything that's clonally propagated can mutate, sometimes in a desirable way, sometimes in an undesirable way. And if a branch comes out that's different, you have to make a decision as to whether you want to keep it. And in some cases, the spore could end up being more vigorous and could overwhelm the desirable variety that you planted originally. So that's possible. I was curious as to whether Japanese maples have a phase change. I don't think they do. Quick Google search.
What's a phase change?
That's where a plant goes from a juvenile phase to a mature phase. And
Oh, you
things
mean
like,
like ivy?
yeah, ivy is a good example. Creeping fig is another example. Citrus, if you grow citrus from seed, you have a long juvenile period where they're very thorny and have sometimes very large leaves and so on. And then after a few years, branches start coming out that are, what you actually were hopefully planting. So there are some plants that have well-known known juvenile to mature phase change. I couldn't, on a quick search, find any evidence that Acer palmatum is one of those plants. I don't think it is, but that's certainly a possibility. But more likely, root sucker or a spontaneous mutation, and you better make a decision now as to whether you want to keep that, because there is a chance, especially with a bigger leaf and greater vigor, that would overtake the plant and it would become the dominant part of what you planted. And as you go in there, you know, and I can see this is a very bushy plant. The Japanese maples have a lot of lower branches if you leave them. As you go in there and make your way in to find where that's arising, I would be curious exactly where it came with respect to the graft, which is usually still visible. There's still usually a visible graft scar. My recollection is they usually use an angle graft for Japanese maples. So you should see sort of a diagonal line about perhaps a foot above the ground. That is the scar. Below that line is rootstock. Above that line is what you purchased and planted, the scion. And look at exactly where that's arising. And that will answer the question as to whether this is a sport or a sucker.
Okay. So the next, you know, Don just keeps sending me these weird things. And this one, the email said wolves as pollinators, question mark?
Yeah.
And it was a link to a news article at Science Magazine.
Yeah, legit site.
Legit site. Well, yeah. So it says, and it has a video. It says, watch Ethiopian wolves drink flower nectar, a first for a large carnivore. Pollen coating their muzzles suggests the endangered canids may act as free pollinators. And they have a video.
Fox. It is the world's rarest wild canid and Africa's most endangered carnivore. It's the Ethiopian wolf. And they have a picture of it here going up and licking the nectar off of Nepophias, red hot pokers, something we sell. So now we can sell Nepophia. By the way, I pronounced it Nepophia my whole life until the emeritus superintendent of the Arboretum told me it was named after a guy named Niphoff. So it should be pronounced Niphoffia. You can call it red hot poker if you wish. That's the very familiar.
And there are yellow versions, which
there are. Yeah, there's yellow and orange and red, and there's some that bloom in the winter. People come in and ask us about that Christmas cheer variety that they see over at the Arboretum. Well, if you want to plant for pollinators, be sure to put in some Niphoffia for the wolves.
And, you know, I can understand why this is an endangered species. This is a carnivore that is out licking honey off a plant.
Yep.
Come on.
So it tells us a couple things. One is that the focus on pollinators, there's a reason I sent this over, tends to focus very heavily on European honeybees, because there's a lot of publicity 2006 when colony collapse disorder hit in a big way and the internet and social media were really expanding and getting going. And so people became aware of this disease that whatever it was, the syndrome that was causing significant die-off of the European honeybees. Beekeepers were going out opening their boxes and significant percentage of the boxes were either empty or the bees were dead. And so it started a 20-year trend now of people planting for pollinators. But the whole focus was on European honeybees. There's so many things that pollinate that we should focus on diversity rather than just planting specifically for European honeybees, which is not actually even native, you know, to America. We have lots of
hummingbirds. We could do hummingbirds, Don.
Everything is, nearly anything can be a pollinator. And the main point is there are a lot of other bees that are native that we can benefit by certain garden practices, like leaving some open, loose soil for the ones that live in the ground. Like when we see bees going to particular plants, let's say the big carpenter bees, the Xylocopa bees, plant more of those, penstemons and salvias and things like that. And be aware that many things are pollinators that we don't really think of. Nobody really has identified exactly what pollinates Chinese date. Ziziphus jojoba, the tree that produces what's called the Chinese date. Ants have been observed pollinating them. Okay. Common Argentine ants have been observed carrying pollen on those trees. So we're thinking of ants as an unpleasant and disreputable thing to have in our garden. And here they are actually functioning as pollinators as well. There's all kinds of things that inadvertently carry pollen from plant to plant. So let's focus on just getting as much diversity as possible, as many different flower types as possible, not go to lists of things that just encourage European honeybees. Look for gardening practices that encourage our native bees as well. The ones that live in the ground are one thing. The ones that live in the stems of old flowers, or in my case on my property, in the narrower stems of bamboo, for example, there's plenty of native bees that live in that old dead sunflower that's still out in your garden that has a hollow stem. There are things living in there, and there are types of bees that are actually native to this area. So in general, the advice is be a little sloppier in your garden. Let some of those flowers just go all the way through their life cycle. If you cut them down, leave them out there, you know, because there's probably a bee in there when you cut it down. There's probably a whole family of them. These are not aggressive. These are not vespids. You're not encouraging yellow jackets or anything like that, at least not with these practices. And so you're encouraging native pollinators, which tend to be rather docile and cool and interesting bees that most people aren't familiar with. Again, they mostly live in the garden refuse, the stuff that your gardening service is cutting down and taking away, the stuff you're chopping down and putting out on the curb for the city to pick up and take and compost. If you could have a pile, okay, somewhere in the back corner, if you don't like the appearance, make a little place for this where you cut down that sunflower and you leave the stem intact and you just throw it on that pile, sort of a semi-working compost pile. You'll get a lot more of the beneficial native pollinators, and you'll find a lot of other things coming in, visiting flowers as well, that may be acting as pollinators. Probably not wolves in our gardens, probably not any mammals of any kind, but you'd be surprised what carries pollen from one plant to another.
Okay, so next up we have, so this is a quote that Don found on a discussion group online, and it says, and I quote, "Gingos support a single insect and so are an ecological dead zone."
Okay. Ginkgo trees have beautiful fall color right now.
They're spectacular.
They're very tough, very long-lived trees. And as long as you get a male cultivar, you'll have a wonderful city tree, street tree, backyard tree, relatively narrow growth habit when they're young, so they fit in a lot of situations. And someone I know, I have a beautiful driveway that's golden leaves right now. I'll be raking them up finally, but I like to let them sit there for as long as possible.
It's so pretty.
They're very pretty, that's right. And for whatever reason, enthusiasts for native tree species like to criticize ginkgos. And this was literally a quote from someone where they posted it on a picture of ginkgo leaves that someone posted. Ginkgos support a single insect, and so they're an ecological dead zone. And I've seen the other phrases that they're ecologically, quote, sterile, end quote. I would like to reply to that politely. Ginkgo trees have many desirable characteristics for urban tree plantings. They are long-lived. They have very few pest problems. Pest problems are the flip side of many insects living on a particular tree. They rarely, if ever, develop root problems. They don't have problems with branch structure. They're very low input trees for city tree crews and so forth. They're very tolerant of pollution. Their leaves do provide habitat on the ground. As I rake those leaves up, there will be all kinds of things scurrying away that were living under that shelter of 3 to 4 inches of leaves above them. Any tree builds soil, has things living in that important interface between the decaying leaves and the native soil. The larvae of leatherwing beetles or soldier beetles develop in the interface of leaves and soil. They're very important aphid predators. I have leatherwing beetles all over my property because of leaving leaves and letting them decay naturally on the ground. Those are not fussy about what species of leaves have come down. They just want leaf litter and they want some moisture. And there's a lot of other beetles and worms and things that inhabit the decaying leaf zone of any tree, including ginkgos. My concern with this is that usually they're saying, therefore you should plant these native species. This goes back to the work of Dr. Tellamy back east, where he's done a lot of research on impact on songbird populations of long-term decisions to plant certain types of non-native trees that don't have fruit or whatever, that don't host the important caterpillars that are food sources for the songbirds. And he's correct about that in Delaware, where he does his work. But no single species or group of trees should be overplanted.
That's right.
And this is whether it's native or not. It should not be overplanted for a couple of rather obvious reasons that are basically the history of urban forestry. Typically, we define that as any more than 10% of the population of trees. So in your city like Davis, we know that right now, Valley Oak, London Plane, Chinese pistache are each about 7 to 10% of the tree species total in the area. So you've got, you know, we're getting close to the recommended maximum with certain species, including our native Valley Oak. We need species diversity to account for pest threats, incoming pest problems. Native species, including the valley oak, are threatened right now in Northern California by the invasive shothole borer, which is now in the Bay Area. It's the last two decades, it's been in Southern California. And there's another borer, the Mediterranean oak borer, which showed up in Marin County 8 years ago and is now in Yolo and Sacramento counties. Valley oak trees were being removed this summer from a park in Sacramento because of infestation and the disease carried by the Mediterranean oak borer. Emerald ash borer, killing ash trees all over the East. It's now established in Oregon, likely to spread this way. The history of urban forestry is one species after another being killed out by a new pest that attacks a particular tree or a particular group of trees. Ginkgo has never had any of those problems. And we've got a couple hundred year history of planting ginkgos in the United States. It is a totally unrelated to all the other trees. A lot of these pests have a very specific host range. They'll be killing all the elms or all the ashes. So that's the pattern of a new pest. Ginkgo isn't related to any of those things. And this is a key issue, is that we want to have a lot of unrelated species planted. Tree Davis just planted 25 trees at a community park here in Davis. Thank you, Rotary folks, for helping out on that. And we did 12 different species. We didn't do 25 elms or 25 oaks or 25 of all the same thing. We did 12 different species, and preferably, as we always try to do, unrelated species, so that if we do get a pest problem, it won't wipe out all 25 of the trees we just put in. Tolerance for increasing heat is important. Ability to grow at less irrigation is important. Tolerance for heavy soils. There's a whole bunch of things that go into these decisions. And one of them, one of the most important ones, is new pests and which species they affect. So I'm always concerned when someone, one, dumps on a non-native species merely to promote native species. That's not a good plan. You can promote native species to their own benefit. Valley oak is a really important pinnacle species here in our ecosystem. It's really crucial. We also know the valley oaks are being killed all over Southern California by this particular pest. And so we want to plant smaller numbers of them in places where it won't matter 30 years from now if we're having to take them out, which is a tragic thing to say, but that's where we're at with this particular pest on this particular species. So promote native plants where they're appropriate. Any tree decision is going to take into account other things than just whether or not there's caterpillars on that tree that feed songbirds. And this comes up so often that I felt compelled to say this now. Ginkgos are wonderful trees. They're great as part of a city tree plan. They're a great tree for a homeowner to plant. If you got room for a native tree, great. Also plant one of those. But be aware that we have a relatively small number of native species here in our part of the Sacramento Valley, literally only 8 or 9 native tree species. And regrettably, each one of them either has issues like the Northern California black walnut, not many people are going to be planting those for one reason or another, or they're threatened by this pest. And this particular invasive shothole borer attacks valley oak, Fremont cottonwood, okay, all our native stream willows. And so that's right there, a significant percentage of the trees that are truly native to this area. A well-run tree program will include sufficient species diversity that if a new pest comes through, you won't wipe out everything on one street. There's a slide that I show when I'm talking about this issue that was taken in a street in Ohio 4 years apart after the emerald ash borer arrived in that community. That street was all ash trees. 4 years later, they were all dead. If it had been 10% ash trees and 10% maple and 10% oak and 10% whatever, only 10% of the trees would be dead. This is the pattern with host-specific pests. And we've got to be really cautious about pushing hard for geographic origin or something that's special to a region and encouraging people to plant more and more and more of those. We need diversity in our tree selections. And ginkgos are beautiful, tough trees with very few problems as long as you get a male. It takes about 10 years for a ginkgo to start flowering and fruiting. When you inadvertently get a female, which does happen, they usually come out right away because it smells horrible. So
that 10% thing is the consideration that people are making when they're planting large quantities of trees, you know, the city, the street tree thing, whatever, in your own home. If you have a new house and you don't have anything in it planted and you plant a tree, hey, one tree is 100% of your species. So don't worry about it.
Well,
plant what you enjoy and try for a little diversity in your yard,
in your neighborhood. This
in
is
your
one of,
neighborhood, yeah.
about
And you
six
can do that with bushes and trees and all sorts of stuff.
about 6 years ago, I gave a presentation to a group in which I made this emphasis. Step outside, look at the trees in your neighborhood. You're about to plant a tree, plant something different.
Oh, that's an easy way to do it,
Yeah,
Tom. Easy way.
it's the look around method. We call it highly sophisticated look around method. Hey, there's a lot of pistachio on this street. Nothing's really hitting pistachio, but it might. I think I'll plant a maple or an oak or whatever. One of the things we're doing, just as a side note, we're planting a lot of red oaks. Tree Davis is planting a lot of red oaks in the city parks and along streets. There's oaks in the genus Quercus are grouped into clades, and they are affiliated, related, might hybridize groups of species. White oaks include our coastal live oak and it includes our valley oak. Those are threatened by the invasive shot hole borer. Red oaks are not being attacked by this shot hole borer. The first thing that happens when a new pest comes into a region is the tree scientists go out and see, does it attack only one group of plants, only one specific species, which is sometimes the case. Host specificity is a really important thing to figure out quickly. And this one came in 25 years ago, Southern California, and there's detailed lists of which species are attacked by it. Which species support the disease that it carries? So those are reproductive hosts. We want to be really careful about planting those. And which species are unaffected? So avocados are a reproductive host of this particular pest. Okay, avocado growers down there are panicking, to put it mildly, because this will just wipe out their orchard unless they treat and spray and do all kinds of stuff. There's others, like the red oaks, are not affected by it. And this is a great place to plant oak trees in general. And red oaks have proven to be very successful. I'm looking out the window at Quercus schumardi that I planted in 1992, and it's 40 feet tall and 50 feet across. It's a spectacular spreading tree. There are several species in the group of red
Ah,
oaks, and
that's the question. Yeah, I've
we're planting.
never heard of a red oak.
Well, Quercus rubra is the one that's often called the red oak, but Quercus schumardi, Quercus bucklii, Quercus texana, Quercus canbii, those are just examples of five species that we're planting around the area that are all doing very well. We're looking for ones from the southwest, if possible, or at least the drier parts of the southeast, which is where most of the red oaks come from, because we think those will be more drought tolerant here. In irrigated settings, they're all doing great. In less irrigated settings, they're mostly doing great. And they look like they'll be a good alternative, since this is a great place for oaks in general, to get away from the valley oak in places where we need a great big spreading shade tree that is not subject to a presently threatening pest. Wherever you're listening, those pests may, different pests may be what regional experts are concerned about. If you're east of the Mississippi, emerald ash borer is everywhere pretty much at this point. It's killing everything in the genus Fraxinus, everything that's an ash tree, pretty much, a few exceptions. So you wouldn't go to a nursery and plant an ash tree, even if it's native, in an area that's being decimated by the emerald ash borer. You simply wouldn't do that. Hopefully the nursery would tell you that. The cycle of this is that these tree scientists, who are a really impressive group of people, frankly, are finding individuals that aren't being affected. They're finding species that aren't being affected. They're already selecting, they're already considering hybridization to do over the next 50 to 75 years. The same thing that's been done with elms, finding replacements for the elms that were decimated by Dutch elm disease. Now there are elms we can sell you that are tolerant or resistant to Dutch elm disease. That took nearly 100 years to get those. And that's what tree scientists do. So next time you see a tree researcher, pat them on the back and say thank you, because they're the ones that are going to make this work in the long run. But there's a really painful period when everything in one genus, everything in one species, everything in one family is killed out by a new pest that's introduced to the United States. And again, that's the history: chestnuts, elms, ash trees, and now it's going to be the oaks in parts of California. It'll be killed out by a particular pest problem. It's a generational thing. These trees, some trees, some of the oaks are being killed by the Mediterranean oak borer, were being taken out in a park in Sacramento this summer, 8 years after that pest arrived in Marin County. So it takes 10 years to start seeing it. Another 10 years before, ooh, there's a lot of this going on. Should we treat all these trees with a systemic insecticide? That's the standard practice in places where these pests show up.
So, Don, you were talking about red oaks, and you
Yeah.
named one, rubrus, which is
Rubra.
actually the red oak. What are the other four names? I mean, not the Latin names, but the people names.
Shumardi red oak, Canby red oak, Texas red oak. Those are three off the top of my head. Oh, Buckley's red oak. I don't know who Mr. Buckley was, but he got a red oak named after him. And these are two of them are from Texas. Texas is, you know, quite a climate. It ranges from wet to dry, depending on which part of the state you're in. But in general, the ones we're trying and are testing, and many have been planted here for 25 or 30 years or more, like the Shumardi I planted in 1992, are proven to be reasonably drought tolerant. Our question in recommending a tree for a major list that's going to be used by landscape architects and city folks, could this tree tolerate 50% ET? If we have a drought and the state requires cutbacks of 30% irrigation, which the last two droughts, that's what they did. Every water district cut your water use 30%. People freaked out. No, that's actually pretty easy to do. The question is, will your tree species be adversely affected by that? Your Japanese maple would not like to go 30% reduction in irrigation. 30% reduction actually is 50% ET. So you can look online, you can find out what your local evapotranspiration rate is, wherever you're listening. You can check it day to day if you want. You can check it hour by hour if you wish. But the key is, can a plant go to 50% of the measured ET? In our area, that's 2 inches a week. 50% of that is 1 inch a week. Can a plant take that without significantly adverse consequences to its appearance, performance, health, vigor, and so on? Most things can. Most woody plants can be watered at 50% ET without any loss in appearance. They might grow a little less that year. If it's a maple, you might get a little leaf burn on, a little cosmetic injury, but they'll probably be fine. Trees that can't should not be on recommended tree lists. And they're garden trees. You're going to water, if there's a drought, you're going to water your Japanese maples and stop watering your lawn. That's a choice you're going to make in order to achieve the 30% reduction, the 50% ET. All of these oaks so far are fine with that. And many of them we're testing in places where Tree Davis is hand watering them for their first 5 years of life. And then they're going to back off and let them essentially be on their own. And some of them are proving adapted to that as well. So basically, you give them the care they need while they're getting going. And if there's irrigation nearby, great. But if there's not, we're curious how some of these will do, and they're doing well. So the red oaks are a really interesting group. The second question we always have about red oaks, is it marcescent?
What's marcescent?
The tendency to have the leaves hang on after they should have fallen off. So oaks are famously marcescent in some cases. Some of them, the brown leaves hang all the way through the winter. Well, that's very undesirable. I know it's just an aesthetic thing. So it's just like we're being grumpy about the fact that there's dead looking leaves on there. People don't like it. So we definitely don't want trees that have strong marcescent. In general, these red oaks are not marcescent. Sort of a quick program note. If you've got a young fruit tree, you planted within the last 2 to 3 years, take a couple pictures. I love the silhouette picture where it's a gray sky, a foggy day, and it's the whole framework of the tree with a gray background. That works particularly well. But whatever you can do, yeah, we might use it, might not, but it's a good starting point for our conversation over the next couple of weeks about how to train and prune fruit trees. DavisGardenShow@gmail.com.
I have a quote here. This is from Sam Llewellyn. I have no idea who that is. But the quote is, in gardens, beauty is a byproduct. The main business of gardens is sex and death.
Welcome to the world of biology. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.